tonight. As we come up in a few months' time to the close of 1999 and enter into the final year of the current millennium in the year 2000, it's worth meditating for a few moments on all the hysteria that we are hearing about the year 2000. There is a huge amount of ignorance and a huge amount of twaddle that is spoken about it. First of all, next year is the last year of the 20th century. Have you ever stopped to wonder why this is called the 20th century, but it begins with the 19 rather than a 20? How come it's the 20th century? Well, think about it. The first century, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 97, 98, 99. When does the first century end? At the end of the 99th year? No, you've only had 99 years. It ends at the end of year 100. That's the first century. The second century begins in the year 101. Second century begins with a 1. And so it goes on. The century is not fulfilled until you get to the number of the century it describes. So the 19th century, the last year was 1900. The 18th century, the last year was the year 1800. And so on. And so with regard to the 20th century, the last year is the year 2000. And it's the end of the year 2000 that will be the end of the millennium. But we should then ask the question, does it matter? Some of you will have heard of a gentleman called Dionysius Exiguus, who is known in English, that was his Latin name, but his English name, because he was English, is Denis the Little. We don't know when he was born, but he flourished in the early 6th century AD. That's the 500s. And he is considered the inventor of the calendar that we currently use. So it wasn't that when Jesus was born, someone said, "Oh, right, now we start counting." No, it wasn't until the 6th century. It wasn't until 500 years after Jesus was born that the present calendar was invented. So it is, this current calendar has been going for less than 1,500 years. So why are we getting so excited about the year 2000? Dennis, when he worked out the calendar, he based it on previous calendars at the request of a pope of the time. St. John I asked him to sort this out in 525, and he based it upon an Alexandrian system which had 95 year tables, and it was based on Victorious of Aquitaine's 532 year cycles. So it was around about 532. He said, right, well, here is the end of the cycle, so the beginning must have been when Jesus was born. Why? Nothing in the Bible says anything about that. It's a total mystery. But he decided Jesus was born at the beginning of one of these cycles, at which he was at the end. And he dated the birth of Christ initially according to the Roman system. And according to the Roman system, Jesus was born on December the 25th, 753. 753 according to the Roman system. A system now long dead and buried, and replaced by Dennis's system. So it's all pick and choose. There is nothing particularly significant about the year 2000. It's not 2,000 years since the birth of Christ, since Herod the Great died in 4 BC. But Herod the Great was alive when Jesus was born. So Jesus must have been born at the latest in 4 BC. So you see, Dennis got it completely and utterly wrong. Now, I've got some pages here if you want to read up more on this and the reasons for these things. I've got 3 pages here, one on Dennis the Little and 2 on the calendar. And calendars have been a problem until modern times, because the rate at which the Earth goes round the Sun is 365.242199 solar days. Or, to put it more simply, 365 days, 5 hours, 48 minutes and 46 seconds. That's the average time it takes for the Earth to go round the Sun. And one of the problems that they had previously had with calendars, because they didn't realise that a year was not exactly 365 days, it was 365 and a bit, all those little bits that they didn't take account of added up, and you eventually ended up planting your seeds in what was supposed to be midwinter, instead of in the spring, because your dates had moved out of alignment. So December would be, in fact, in the middle of the summer. And it all went haywire. And so they had to bring it back together again so the dates fitted with the seasons. So Midsummer's Day actually was Midsummer's Day instead of being somewhere else in the year. This was done a couple of times, and the last time was in the 16th century. And when this was finally sorted out in the 16th century, they did it very well. And they introduced leap years. Now, here's a question for you. I wonder if anyone knows the answer. Is this statement true or false? Every fourth year is a leap year. Is that true or false? Hands up if you think it's true. Hands up if you think it's false. You are correct, it is false. Mostly every fourth year is a leap year. But the century years, like 1700, 1800, 1900, were not leap years. In fact, Ruth Rendell, if you ever read any of her books or watch any of the dramatisations of them on the television, based a whole novel around the fact that 1900 was not a leap year. Next year is a leap year. And the way you work it out is that year, is the century year divisible by 4? 2000 you can divide by 4. 1900, 1700, 1800, you can't divide by 4. The previous century year that had a leap year was 1600. Divisible by 4. Sorry, 400, not by 4. 400. I wondered why my wife was looking blankly at me. Yes, the century year, 16, 17, 1800, so on, has to be divisible by 400. 2000 is, 1600 was, but the ones in between weren't. So that means that at the end of the next century, the year 2100 will not be a leap year. But people have got really excited about calendars. And they got really excited about the year 2000. And I cannot understand what all the fuss is about. Oh, but it's 200 years since Christ was born. No, it's not. That was a few years ago. So we're getting worked up for no good reason. Oh, but we changed from the 1900s to the 2000s. Big deal. It's a totally artificial numbering system. We could equally well do what the Muslims did. Because if you talk to a Muslim, he dates time from some event in the life of Muhammad in the 600s. And so we're, as far as a Muslim is concerned, we're in the 1300s. And so it's entirely arbitrary where you take your fixed point from which you measure. Of course, in the good old days, back in the times of the Bible, they didn't do anything like that. It was all done on the basis of the reigns of the king. So, for example, in Luke chapter 3, now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea and so on. And so the year is dated according to who the emperor was. Or, if you go back into the Old Testament, who the king was. And this was common. You go to Egypt and you look at things in Egypt. Everything is dated upon the basis of who was the pharaoh. Now you can get problems because you've got overlaps. And there's a big hole in Egyptian chronology, because most Egyptologists say that, I'll probably get this wrong, but I think it's the 26th dynasty followed the 25th dynasty. But in fact, when you examine it more closely, They happened at the same time. That these set of pharaohs all lived contemporaneously. And so that completely throws out all the chronology. There are examples in the Old Testament where you read one passage and it said, this happened during the reign of, in this year. And you look in another part of the Bible and it says, this happened in the reign of, same event, but they give different dates. And you think, well, that can't be right. One must be wrong. Well, in fact, they're both right. Because they use different methods of dating. One would have said, right, well, the king came to the throne halfway through a year. Well, we'll discount the rest of that year, and his year one is the next year. Whereas the other one says, no, no, we'll include all of that year, even though it was only half a year, and say that was his year one. In addition to which, some people said the year began at Easter, and another group of people said, no, the year began in September. And so you get all these problems all mingled in together, and you're often left scratching your head thinking, well, which is which? Well, there is a man, Edwin Teeley, who worked all this out, and he published it in a book in 1950, and he solved a problem that had been causing headaches for people virtually since the Bible was written. How can these things fit together? And he's shown how they all fit together perfectly. There was an article written in 1948 by a man who said, you cannot accept the historical accuracy of the Bible. Here is an example. These dates don't match. 3 years later, Edwin Teeley proved that the dates matched perfectly. This man writing in 1948 was shown to be wrong. He'd made an assumption. Here's an error that cannot be understood in any way other than an error. Teeley showed him wrong. So dates have significance in that it's useful to know what we're doing next week. It's useful to know when things have happened in the past. But is there any significance or importance in specific dates from a biblical point of view? Has God tied himself to dates? So, does the Bible make a big thing about Easter? No. Apart from the events about Christ's death that are recorded in the Gospels, you never find any mention of Easter in the rest of the New Testament. Christmas? Nothing. What about the Ascension? After the event? Nothing. It wasn't remembered. They knew it happened, but every year they didn't say today is Ascension Day, today is Easter Sunday, today is this, that and the other. The only thing that appears to have concerned the believers as we read through the New Testament is Sundays. They met together on Sundays. And Sunday was a working day for them, but they met once a week to remember the death of Christ. Didn't wait once a year, once a week. Remember the death of Christ and his resurrection. That was the important calendar for them, once a week. Not once a month or once a year, once a week. Now, down through the centuries, people have invented various things. Christmas is an invention. Easter is an invention. You don't find Easter as we know it in the scriptures. You don't find Christmas as we know it in the scriptures. And just like every other date that is special in certain denominations, every day of the year has something assigned to it. In the Church of England, you have a special date, and then the Sundays after it are the first after Easter, the second after Easter, and then eventually you get to Trinity Sunday, and then you have a large number of weeks after Trinity Sunday, and it's first, second, third after Trinity until you get to Advent. Now, you can perhaps understand that this might have been helpful to people when they were living in ignorance and couldn't read the scriptures and were kept in darkness by the clergy, which happened for hundreds and hundreds of years. But do we still need that? Well, of course we don't. Did we ever need that? Well, probably not, if the Bible had been taught as it should have been. But then you get people who jump up and down and get very excited because 2,000. This is very significant. There are people especially Americans. I don't know what it is about the Americans, but it happens to be a fact. The Americans are getting very excited about 2000. They're saying 2000 years since the birth of Christ, so something significant is going to happen in the year 2000. And perhaps this will be the year that Christ will return. Does the scripture give us any indication about this? Well, you can do what I have done, which is to look up 1000 in the Bible. You'll discover hundreds of references. And after you've waded through the first 20 or so that talk about 20,000 people, you'll think, I must narrow this down somehow. So you narrow it down to 1000 years, or thousands of years. And that gives you something much more manageable. It gives you 4 references. Let me read them to you. And let's see what God says in these references about 1000 years. In the Psalms, Psalm 90 and verse 4. God says, for 1000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, and like a watch in the night. What does this say? This says that God inhabits eternity. And as far as God is concerned, what we consider vast areas of time are as nothing. Because what is 1000 years when you compare it to eternity? It's a drop in the bucket. It's even less than that. Less than a joey in the bucket. If you know what a joey is, when you drop something into water, you get a splash, and this little tiny droplet comes up. That's called a joey. So it's smaller than a droplet in a bucket of water. You turn to Ecclesiastes, just a few books on from the Psalms. Ecclesiastes chapter 6 and verse 6. We'll read from verse 5 because it's breaking into a sentence. Though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this has more rest than that man, even if he lives 1000 years twice over, that has not seen goodness. Do not all go to the same place? So it's talking about a man. It's not possible, but even if it were, if he lived 2000 years, wouldn't make any difference, he still ends up in the same place. Now some people, and I'm sure some Americans would say, 2000 years twice, 1000 years twice, that's 2000 years, this must have significance. Yes, but even if that did have significance, and we should use that as looking at when this 2000 years comes to an end, 2000 years from when? 2000 years from when this was written? Well, this would be written during the time of David and Solomon. That was about 900 BC. Well, that brings us up to 1100. Well, that's no good. And this is what people do, just as an aside. They find some number, they invest it with special significance, and they work out a starting point that brings the end point to within the next few years. And people have been doing this for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they have always been proved wrong. And even though they've been proved wrong, sometimes they have said, oh no, we weren't wrong, we misunderstood. What it meant was this. So you have the so-called Jehovah's Witnesses saying, well, of course, 1914 was a very special date. As we can see, the First World War began. There's no mention of the First World War in the Bible. Their whole theory has no basis in the Bible. And it just happened that they plucked this number out of the air. It's actually based on the dimensions of the Great Pyramid, amongst other things. And what's that got to do with the things of God? And they came up with it in 1914. It just happened to coincide with the start of the First World War. Well, almost anything happens in any given year, and you can say, oh, that was the event that we meant. The Bible says we should have none of it. In 2 Peter, good grief, we're jumping nearly to the end. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8. But beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as a thousand years, and a thousand years as one day. So it's saying the same sort of thing as it says in Psalm 90. But here Peter is saying it both ways. It's amazing the number of people who say, oh well, it says day there, but of course this is a prophetic day, and a prophetic day is a thousand years, as it says in the Bible. A day is as a thousand years. Yes, but let's read the context. And a thousand years as one day. It proves nothing. All Peter is saying is that as far as God's concerned, time is irrelevant. He is outside of time. Time does not affect him. And the final references are to be found almost at the very end. Revelation chapter 20. And this is found in a book that is full of symbolism and full of numbers which are symbolic. And we read this. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit, and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who was the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up and set a seal on him, so that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years were finished. But after these things he must be released for a little while. And I saw thrones, and they sat on them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead did not live again until 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power. But they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Now when 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison, and will go forth to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. What does that tell us? Well, it tells us nothing. It's a symbolic number, as throughout the whole of the rest of Revelation. It's not telling us that there will be anything literal about the number of years. It's telling us that there will be a long period. And I believe that what's being said here is that the devil was bound when Christ was on earth. The strong man entered into the devil's camp, seized him, bound him, thus preventing him from deceiving the nations so the gospel can spread forth over the whole world until the end, when Christ returns. That's all it says. It doesn't say that anything will happen after 1,000 years, and so therefore 1,000 years from Jesus, so therefore, well, we're still here, aren't we? Or 1,000 years from his death or his resurrection, we're still here. Well, perhaps it must be 2,000 years. Well, why? It's 1,000 years. Either we have to say it's literal, or we have to say it's symbolic. Now, the way people get around this in various ways, and they say, oh, 1,000 years hasn't started yet. It starts after Christ returns. But that's not what the Bible speaks about. The Bible speaks about Christ returning, and that's the end. There's nothing after he returns. It's eternity after he returns. But people want there to be something special to look forward to. So what does Jesus tell us? And we read it in chapter 24. As we read chapter 24, he's answering questions. And he's answering two questions. And this is what confuses people. There are two questions answered here. Jesus at the beginning points, they point out the temple to him, he says it's going to be destroyed. Verse 3, now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when will these things be? When will the destruction of the temple take place? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And this is what's led to confusion. People have assumed that what follows is the answer to a single question. And it's not. It's the answer to three questions. And from here down to verse 33 happened in AD 70. How can I be so confident in that? Verse 34. Assuredly I say to you, this generation, you lot that I'm speaking to, will not pass away till all these things are fulfilled. And people say, well, that can't be right, because look, it says, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Jesus said all these things, including that, so we have to understand that in a different way. You can read various statements by the Apostle Paul talking about this gospel, which has been preached in all the world. Did he mean it had been preached in Australia? No. He meant the gospel had gone forth into the known world throughout the Roman Empire. That must be what he means. He doesn't mean that he's been off to Australia and South America. They didn't know South America existed. No, there would be a broad spread of the gospel. But what about verse 29? The sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, the powers of the heaven will be shaken. This hasn't happened yet, hasn't it? If you do a cross-reference, you'll find there are three references in the Old Testament that say exactly the same. Concerning the destruction of Egypt, the destruction of Babylon, and the destruction of Eden. These happened in the past. So Jesus is using these words not in a modern, Western sense. He's using them in a biblical, Jewish, Eastern sense, dated in the first century. And that's how we must understand the Bible, on its own terms. Not to come to the Bible and say, oh, I know what that means. You've got to ask yourself, what does the Bible mean by these words? And you find that these phrases are used to describe a great catastrophe, a great destruction, an end of a city, of a race, of a nation. And it's such a big catastrophe. It's as if the sun was dark and the moon ceased to give its light. That's what the Bible itself says about these things. Jesus knew his Bible. It's no surprise that he quotes from the Old Testament frequently. And we must take that verse in the light of what he knew of the old. So there is nothing there that causes a problem in saying all that took place in AD 70. But notice he warns and he gives signs and says, this will happen, that will happen, the other will happen. And when you see these things, flee. Flee from the city. Flee from Judah. Flee out into the mountains. And what happened in AD 70? The Christians saw these things happening and they fled and they were delivered. And so the great tribulation that Jesus speaks of here happened in AD 70. It's not something in the future, it's in the past. So he's answered the question, when will the temple be destroyed? And when will be the end of the age? The end of the age was the end of the Jewish age. The end of the law. And God brought that period, the old covenant, to an end in AD 70. Clearly signify that by destroying the temple, wiping away the Jewish sacrificial system, never to be reinstituted again. But then what does he say? Verse 36. But of that day and hour, no one knows. No, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. He's now talking about his coming. When is he going to come as a judge? Now, we read about the judgment at the end of chapter 25. He comes, he sits on a throne, and he judges the nations and separates the sheep from the goats. But you read from there, all the way through the end of chapter 24 into chapter 25, there is not one single sign that he says look out for. Not one. He doesn't say in after 2,000 years this is going to happen, so be ready for it. He doesn't say on the 25th of January 2075 I'm going to come back. He says, I don't know when I'm going to come back. And you don't know when I'm going to come back. Nobody knows. So anybody who says there are any significant dates in the future and names them, you know they're wrong. You know they don't understand the Bible. You know they don't know what Jesus said. You know that you can safely ignore anything they say. Is the year 2000 of any significance? Well, ask me that on the 1st of January 2001. That's the only way we'll know. Will 2001 be significant? Ask them on the 1st of January 2002. There is no way of knowing beforehand. It is not possible. Jesus says, you don't know, so therefore you must always be ready. Christ might return tonight. Are we ready for his return tonight? When he returns, we will be taken off and we will stand before him in judgment. And he will judge us according to how we have lived. Are we ready for that event? Well, we must ask ourselves very seriously, are we ready for that event? And when God says to us, why should I not cast you into hell? What will our answer be? We cannot say, oh, I've never sinned, because we know we've sinned. And God knows full well that we've sinned. We can't hide it from him. So what are we going to say? Well, I tried my best. I really worked hard. But we've still sinned. And we can never work hard enough to deal with our sins. It's often said that when you've dug yourself into a hole, the best thing you can do is to stop digging. Because the more you dig yourself into a hole, the deeper you get. And the more we sin, and we sin every day, we dig the hole deeper and deeper and deeper. How are we going to get out of the hole? We look up and it's disappearing into the distance. We've dug a hole so big for ourselves. How are we going to get out? Well, first of all, we've got to stop digging. And we've got to say, I am here in this mess, in this hole, because of what I have done. I am the problem. How am I going to get out? I can't get out by myself. So no matter how much I labour, no matter how hard I work, I'll never get out of the hole. So people suddenly become very religious. But becoming religious will do you no good. Because just by reading the Bible, just by going along to church, just by putting money into boxes, just by doing religious things, it does no good. You'll see thousands upon thousands of people around the world who are very religious. But you say to them, why should God let you into heaven and not cast you into hell? They've really got no answer. They've got no confidence. Because they're trying to get themselves out of the hole. And they can't. What they need is for someone who's at the top of the hole to reach down somehow and pull them out of the hole. We need the help of someone outside of us. And that's what God has done for us in Christ. It's Christ who delivers us from sin. It's Christ who delivers us from hell. It's Christ who prepares us for heaven. And you'll say, but you said it's not a religious answer, and suddenly you're introducing a religious answer. Well, this is not a religious answer in the sense that it's normally understood. It's an answer insofar that it's not a religious answer insofar as we don't do anything ourselves. Christ does it for us. We cry to him. Well, is there any merit in the fact we call to him? Well, no. We're just acknowledging we're in a hole. He comes and he takes us and he pulls us out. It's because of him, not because of us. Oh, but that means you can live as you like. Absolutely. And how do you like to live? A person who is a real Christian likes to live a godly life. A person who is not a Christian couldn't give two hoots about living a godly life. It's a Total difference of motivation. So were Christ to come tonight, would we be ready? And in the morning, should we discover that he hasn't come tonight, do we say, oh, well, he didn't come last night, so I don't need to worry about tonight? No, he doesn't say that. The illustrations that he gives here are the fact that nobody knows, nobody can know till it happens, because had they known, they would have prepared the day before. But because you can't know the day before, you have to be ready every day. And he gives this illustration, but know this, that if the master of the house had known at what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Suppose you got a note through the door saying that tonight, at 7:36, a burglar would break into your house and steal all your property. If you had received such a message, I would have to ask you, what on earth are you doing here? Why are you sitting here listening to me? This is stupid. Why aren't you at home sitting there, waiting for the man to try and break in so you can catch him and get the police to come and apprehend him? It's because you haven't received such a note. You don't believe that that would happen. You think that your house is secure. That's what Ruby Hentel thought. Ruby Hentel was a woman who would now, I think, be in her 70s, if she's still alive. We knew her in South London. And one Sunday morning, she was sitting in the chairs, listening to me preach on this very passage. And when she got home, she discovered she'd been burgled. Poor Ruby. It's heartbreaking. Had she known, she wouldn't have been sitting listening to me. She'd have been at home making sure that the burglars didn't get in. It's just the same when Christ comes. He's not going to give us any advance warning. He's not going to send us any notes saying, by the way, it's next week. He's going to come, and it will be unexpected. Anybody who tells you, we know when he's going to come, we have special knowledge, you know that they're self-deceived. You know that you can safely ignore them. Anyone who says, he's coming next year, 2,000 years. 2,000 years from what? It's an invented dating system. In the scriptures, he has invested no evidence that tells us that 2,000 years has any significance at all. So why all the fuss? What we should be concerned about is, firstly, do I know God and the forgiveness of my sins? And secondly, am I walking with God and seeking to be godly? Whether he comes tonight or in 10,000 years, I should be living in a godly manner. That's the important thing. It's not a question of, oh, what's the date, what's the time? It's a question of, do I know God? Do I know the forgiveness of my sins? Am I seeking to be a godly person while I'm here? Because one day, for certain, I will leave this world. One day I will stand before God and give an account of my life. Although, of course, it's not my life, it's God's life that he has given to me. I belong to God as you belong to God. That's why we must give an account to him of what we've done. Whoever we are, however old we are, however young we are, one day we must stand before God. One day we must give an account. Are we ready for that day? We don't know when we're going to die. Some of us might live only for another day. Some of us might live for another 50 years. Who knows? But we know this. We will die. We will stand before God. It might be in the year 2000. It might be in the year 2050. Are we ready for that date when we will die, when we will leave this world, when we will go and face God? That's the important question. And that's the disappointing thing about all this hoo-ha about the millennium. That they will make mention of religion. They'll make mention of Jesus Christ in passing. But there's no mention at all of the fact it has no real significance. And no mention of the fact that all of us one day must face God. Are we ready to face God? While the rest of the world goes and behaves in such a silly way, are we ready? The world will laugh at us. Why aren't you making preparations for the millennium? I'm making preparations for meeting with God. I think that's far more important. Are you making preparations to meet with God? By what you believe and the way you live. Let that be the thing. That these events, let that be the thing that these celebrations drive us to. That on the day of judgment, when we see God, we will not be disappointed.